Happy Friday, people. When did everybody start saying Happy Friday?
Ever since Fridays began.
No, I don't think so. I think this is a somewhat new thing.
You think?
Yeah, I think. I think it's like everybody says Happy Friday.
Well,
Happy Friday.
I mean, it makes sense, right? Everybody's happy on Friday.
How were they doing this in the, you know, in the 80s?
The Pleistocene? No, no, it is a recent phenomenon.
Yeah.
But I think your original intro that you taped over was actually about.
Oh, it's terrible. I had this horrible intro. It lasted about 3 seconds. I said, well, that was awful. And then I said, let's start over. So happy Friday. Hope everybody's enjoying themselves. I do love a good Friday. It is June 6th. Watch Fantasy Baseball today. We'll have John Heyman on to talk about the MLB draft, which was yesterday, today, and tomorrow. First two rounds were yesterday. Email us, fantasybaseball@cbsi.com. If we have time, I want to get to some more Grade the Trade and some emails at the end of the show. As promised, we're going to talk about strategies that have been effective and those that have been ineffective so far in our fantasy leagues. And, of course, we'll help you out in Week 11. We'll talk about Justin Verlander, Drew Pomeranz, Chris Davis is walking more, striking out less, injury updates, and Todd Frazier's really good. So here we go. I have a trivia question for you.
Okay.
Who, in their last 16 appearances, has allowed 7 hits, no runs, 1 walk, and 16 strikeouts?
Probably some closer that we don't think is very good.
Mm-hmm.
How about Jonathan Papelbon?
Well, I know there's a closer who, since he became the closer 9 appearances ago, has allowed just 1 base runner on a hit.
So just say his name because you figured it out.
Yeah.
It's Chad Qualls.
It is Chad Qualls.
Yeah.
16 appearances and 7 hits, 1 walk. And I might have recorded the strikeouts wrong. I don't know if it's 16. It's right around a strikeout per inning. But yeah, what do you guys make of that? He's been really good.
You know, I should have maybe guessed Chad Qualls because I've been noticing in the box scores, hey, it's been pretty good lately.
Mm-hmm.
Got that whipped down to like 116, I think, when it was in like the mid ones when he took over as a closer. And he's been, I mean, he's been a serviceable reliever for more of his career than not. I don't really think he's closer caliber, but you know, a lot of relievers have done pretty well in the role that weren't really closer caliber pitchers. So he's still pretty low on my list, both because he pitches for the Astros and because with his stuff, there's a thin margin for error. But he should not be ignored, clearly.
Yeah, okay. There you go. Just wanted to throw that out there for everybody in case you were missing it. Chad Qualls is owned in like 25% of leagues. Al, it's a little hot in here today. Are you going to cramp up?
I'm not prone to cramping.
Okay, that's good.
And I got to fully disclose here. I didn't watch any of it.
Oh, why not?
Partly I was watching the disappointing matchup that was Ventura Waka.
Oh, you mean stat of the day number one, which is Yordano Ventura and Michael Waka combined for 2 strikeouts in 12 innings?
I wasn't trying to help you with the segue, but, you know, if I can do that, then I'm happy to help you.
That was pretty weird. They both pitched fine. Waka, 6 innings, 3 runs. Ventura, 6 innings, 2 runs, but 1 strikeout for each guy. And Waka, 19 Ks and 31 innings pitched over his last 5. So what do you guys think?
That is the first I've heard of that stat. It's
only 1 good strikeout game.
I don't make a lot of it.
Nah.
But
and he was cruising along in this game until he was the 5th inning when the Royals started. I think at that point the Royals had 1 hit, and then they hit him up a bit in the 5th, and then the 6th was when he gave up the runs.
Both guys, by the way, are at right around a strikeout per inning. So maybe they're just regressing to the mean or something like that.
I mean, they weren't bad starts. It's just, you know, we kind of had hyped it up. I don't know, maybe it wasn't even on the air, but here in the office we were a little excited.
I would have been excited too, but I went all NBA Finals on you. And let's talk about Justin Verlander. Here's your quote of the day. Quote, "My fastball was great today, but I just missed some off-speed pitches. If I execute those 4 or 5 pitches, this would have been a fantastic game. I feel like I'm turning the corner with the mechanical adjustments I've made. I know the results don't reflect that, but I felt great out there." That was Verlander. 7 innings, 8 hits, 6 runs, 5 earned, 4 walks, 4 strikeouts, 2 home runs allowed. The good news is he's only allowed 6 home runs this year, even with 2 yesterday. But I just kind of remember going back to last year and even in this recent bad stretch, he gives a lot of quotes like this. He is an eternal optimist.
Right. I wish I could share his optimism. I don't.
Maybe it's, you know, dating Kate Upton. You know, gives a
lot of confidence. I wouldn't give a crap about giving up two home runs if I were dating Kate Upton.
Now, I left my yellow legal pad somewhere else this morning. I was stunned to find out as the podcast began.
Yeah, I'm stunned too.
Yeah.
Those are like your pants. You never leave home without them.
So Verlander in his previous start, 7 strikeouts to 1 walk. But if you take that start out of the equation, something like his last 5, it's a 1-to-1 ratio. It's really not what you expect for a frontline pitcher. It's basically what Jared Cozart does, and it's the reason we don't like him. So that's scary to see from somebody who you drafted to be your ace. And I think both of us have dropped him out of how low do you have him in the rankings?
I think
now?
About 25th.
Yeah, I don't think I'm quite that low, but I think right around just outside the top 20, maybe.
Honestly, having him where I have him, I was still giving him benefit of the doubt.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, ready?
No.
All right, let me know when you're ready.
Ready.
Gio Gonzalez or Justin Verlander?
Verlander, but, you know, Gio comes back here soon and lights it up first time out. That may change.
Yeah, I've got them pretty close. I think I've got Verlander still ahead of Gio.
How about Michael Wacha?
I have Wacha ahead
of Verlander.
Mm-hmm.
If I don't, I should. I would rather have Wacha.
How about Sonny Gray?
Verlander.
Yeah. It's very close, though.
Okay. Well, that should give us an idea of where we have Verlander right now. Disappointing yesterday, Mr. Verlander. But, you know, Kate Upton, so you win. Email of the day number one is from Ben from Honolulu. I love league disputes, guys. I love them.
If you guys
have league disputes, send them in.
What are you, the youngest child in your family?
Mm-hmm.
Love those disputes?
Why?
Like, who loves a dispute? From my perspective, it's like...
Well, it's not like...
Avoid it at all costs.
No, I don't... I like them in other people's leagues. You know, like,
oh, okay.
Like dogs. I like other people's dogs. I just don't want to have to deal with the responsibility myself.
Like
so
watching
an
episode of All in the Family or some other sitcom where they argue all the time.
Exactly.
Okay.
I just
strong call there.
I've never seen All in the Family, but sure. All right. Here's the email from Ben. I have a league dispute I was hoping you could address. I'll try to make this as brief as possible. 12-team league. Top 8 go to the playoffs. It's roto scoring, but we play head-to-head. So I'm guessing
top
that means
8
categories.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a lot of playoff teams. But
the NHL.
5 keepers. The guy in 9th place is a half game behind the 8th place guy, but he's already trying to play for next year. He traded Jose Bautista, a 24th rounder and a 27th rounder, to the 6th place team for Chris Owings and a 1st and a 4th rounder next year. The picks are, of course, after the 5 keeper rounds, so a first-round pick's actually more like a 6th-round pick. Some guys think it's way too early to dump your dump, while others think it's perfectly fine. What do you think? Is this a vetoable move, just Bush League, or neither?
How about both? I do think it's vetoable. I don't think, as far as dumps go, it's a bad one.
What do you mean?
I mean, he should have gotten something better. I mean, I understand. Okay, so he got a first rounder, which again is really like a 6th rounder, but I think he should have gotten maybe a lesser keeper in return. Or I don't know.
Wait,
I mean,
I'm confused.
So somebody better than Chris Owings, you're saying?
Yeah.
In return? Along with the picks there?
Yeah. It's like he's dumping one of the best players in fantasy for, you know, I mean, there's no pick in this draft that's going to even come close to being worth that.
Right. But if he's really out of it and has nothing more to play for,
is there a lesser
half game
keeper
out
then?
Of the playoffs.
A lesser keeper, his last keeper, second to last keeper he could trade for those picks? Bautista's going to help you for a few more years.
The thing is, like,
I get what you're saying.
If you're in 9th place, you might be able to make the playoffs, but you could look at your lineup and say, there's no way I'm winning the league.
Right.
Right.
No,
I get
I'm not
what you're saying. You need another.
Yeah.
You need another, just to for the keeper aspect of Bautista, you need another player to make up for that along with the high draft pick, and then that would make sense.
At the very least.
Yeah.
And yeah, and I'm thinking he probably could have gotten away. I mean, look, I don't know the league, so I'm assuming a lot here, but you know, I just don't like the fact that you're trading a guy that you could keep for at least a couple more years who could help you win a championship.
So it sounds to me like you don't mind the ethical.
No.
You know, you don't mind what happened. You just don't think it was a good trade.
Right.
How about you?
Yeah, I think I agree with that assessment. I'm really not one for vetoing trades, except in a clear case of collusion. And in a clear case of collusion, you probably need to eliminate the people from the league as opposed to just vetoing their trade.
Right.
So I'm not for vetoes happening. I'm for letting people make mistakes. And I don't think one player, obviously getting Jose Bautista without giving up much of anything this year, helps that guy's chances for sure, but it doesn't. It's not like he automatically wins the league, and if he doesn't win the league, it could hurt losing those draft picks. I mean, like Al said, it's not because of the keeper aspect and the fact that he could keep Jose Bautista beyond this year, it doesn't hurt as much.
Yeah,
but I can understand why the guy who traded away Bautista is doing it. I just don't think he got enough value back, like Al said.
Yeah. Okay, so then let's do the Thursday standouts, get to the injuries, news, and notes, talk strategy, and then we'll look ahead to Week 11, help you set your lineup. All right, Scott, I read your little update on Drew Pomeranz.
That little update.
You're smitten
so
again.
Cute. Yeah.
So he goes out and he has 7 innings of 6 hits, 2 runs, 1 earned, 1 walk, 7 strikeouts against the worst team in baseball, the New York Yankees. And you're back on. You're back in.
I never really jumped off, let's be clear.
That's
I started to have some doubts, but I was still always saying Pomeranz when you said Pomeranz
yep,
or this guy.
That's true. You never said to drop him or anything like that. But now you're like smitten again.
Oh, yeah. Go 7 innings. First time we've seen him go even 6, and through 100 pitches, seems like he's fully stretched out now, so that's not really a concern anymore. Obviously, the previous 2 starts were kind of shaky. He walked some guys, but you're talking about 4 out of 6 now where he has been dominant. I mean, it didn't really show up in terms of fantasy production the first 3 because he went only 5 innings, but 4 out of 6 dominant, 2 kind of shaky, neither terrible. That's a good pitcher, and given Pomeranz's pedigree, all he had to deal with in Colorado before this, I think it makes sense that he's taken this step forward now that he's in a good pitcher's environment.
Okay. I took your advice. I didn't drop him. I don't think I dropped him in
any I know.
Leagues.
I wish you had.
Yeah.
In the podcast league, the podcast head-to-head points league.
I thought about it.
I think I saw Adam drop this guy, but then I saw you still had him.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I'll say is when was the last time a pitcher didn't pitch well against the Yankees? They made Ricky Nolasco.
Oh, come on.
No, look what Nolasco and Correa did last week in Yankee Stadium. They're ice cold right now. Just saying. Then Phil Hughes went out and had like 8 innings of 2 runs.
That's what Phil Hughes does now.
Yeah, but against the Yankees, that was shocking to me.
Yeah, they're ice cold. Willy Peralta, who's worried? Last 4 starts, 5.40 ERA. Opponents are batting .294 and 11 walks, 19 strikeouts.
He's been meh, but he hasn't been terrible, so I'm not worried.
I'll tell you what actually concerned me the most when I looked at the game logs here. Look at the 4 starts: at Atlanta, at Miami, the Cubs, and at Minnesota.
It doesn't get too much better than that, although the Marlins are hitting.
Yeah,
but you would hope at least maybe he walks away from that stretch with a whole lot of strikeouts, which he didn't. But I don't really expect Peralta to develop into that strikeout guy at this point. I had some hope going into the season for that, but I think he's just going to be one of the many pitchers who is going to usually have really good control and not give up a lot of runs, but the strikeouts aren't necessarily going to be there.
So what separates him from somebody like Mike Leake? I found when before he was up in the top or close to the top 50 for me, maybe up there with Hyunjin Ryu. Now he's gotten pushed down. Not that I've downgraded him. Not that I feel like I've downgraded him that much, like just dragging him down to the rankings, you know, but he's down closer to Mike Leake now for me. And I'm having a hard time feeling bad about it.
It's kind of funny that you asked that question, because in researching this week's first pitch column, I had the same conundrum distinguishing between Leake and his former rotation mate Arroyo. And I think what separates both those guys from Peralta, not a lot, by the way, but Peralta, whereas those guys are more like 5.5 Ks per nine, I do think Peralta will be more like a 7 K per nine guy. And I also think Peralta will be a little better than them at avoiding home runs, even though Leake's a ground ball pitcher.
Do you guys like Peralta or Pomeranz better?
I like Pomeranz significantly better.
I'll take Peralta, but not by as much as I would have before.
Anyone else? Any other standouts?
Oh, so Scott forgot his yellow pad that doubles as his pants, apparently.
not a good thought.
A couple of hitters in the notes. Scott and I were actually talking on our way in. We really, you know, not a lot that stood out in these games last night to us. But Aaron Hill, and this is also partly because, as I mentioned, I think on yesterday's podcast, I kind of did a second base overhaul in my rankings. And Aaron Hill has really been disappointing. Just too many Ks, not enough home runs, because that's what you draft him for. And I don't have an explanation at this point, but you know, he's kind of on my watch in terms of somebody who might not meet expectations. Michael Choi's had a nice game.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Davis has only struck out 3 times in his last 9 games.
Chris
twice
with a
yesterday.
K.
Chris with a K.
Yeah, homered yesterday, though.
He did.
It had been a couple days since he did that.
Yeah, I know. It was like a huge cold stretch. 3 games, I think, without a homer.
Yeah.
I know you had him, Scott, as a start with this week with all the good matchups, but I think the walk to strikeout stuff is pretty encouraging.
Definitely.
6 walks, 7 Ks in his last 14 games.
Definitely. And I moved him up a little in the rankings last night. Still not near where he started out for me. And I have him actually behind Willingham, who didn't homer yesterday but had a couple walks and I think a hit. But ahead of Arcia. So he's kind of in the same range as those Twins outfielders who are getting so much hype right now.
But that's your points league order. What about your Roto league?
No, it's Roto also.
Oh, you're going Willingham over Arcia and Roto?
Yeah, okay. I am.
Arcia, by the way, sprained his ankle yesterday. So let's do the injuries news and notes. Mike Trout returned to the lineup. He doubled and he tripled. And CJ Cron did not start, and I'm hoping it was because Trout had to DH and Ibanez was in the outfield. Edwin Encarnacion missed yesterday's game with his back injury. He could play tonight. Carlos Gonzalez could need surgery on his finger. Washington manager Matt Williams said he hopes Bryce Harper can be back on July 1st, but Harper said there's no timetable. John Heyman reports Gregory Polanco should be up by next week, and John Heyman reports that Milwaukee and Seattle are interested in Kendrys Morales. And those two teams, including a couple of others, look more likely to sign Morales than the Yankees.
It's a mystery team in there.
Yeah.
Love the mystery team.
We don't know if Matt Latos will make another rehab start or return to the Reds rotation. Noah Syndergaard hurt his non-throwing shoulder / collarbone area covering home plate yesterday.
Oh, that's not
good.
Yeah. Colton Wong left Thursday's game when he re-aggravated his shoulder injury that I didn't know he had.
Neither did I.
Yeah, I mean, The recap I read today made it seem like he sat Wednesday partially because of the shoulder.
You know, now in retrospect, I do remember that reading that in yesterday's recap, and I thought, no, he sat because they were facing a left-hander. That's what he always does.
Right, yeah. And I'm not sure that he didn't, right? That's 5 in a row, you said, right, since he came off the DL?
Yeah, 5 against lefties, yeah.
Carlos Beltran returned. He went 0-3 with 2 strikeouts. He batted 5th. Matt Cain will start today against the Mets. Chris Carter walked 4 times yesterday. That's cool. John Singleton stole a base. Does he do that?
No.
No. He's done.
Nick Marquette gets homered again. He has 5. Eddie Butler will make his debut today for the Rockies against the Dodgers. Starter sit.
Sit.
J.J. Putz began a rehab assignment. He's actually was pitching pretty well before. Well, just before he went on the DL, he was struggling. But Putz had a decent year, so Do you think he could be in the closer mix if Addison Reed struggles?
I think he could.
And Alfonso Soriano singled, doubled, and drove in a run, and he started against a left-handed pitcher.
Is cold streak over.
He plays most of the time, left-handers. Can I circle back to one thing you said here?
Please.
Cargo could need surgery on his finger. Now, he was one I had a really hard time with going through the rankings yesterday because I already had him 11th in the outfield before he went on the DL. And the players just behind him are like Justin Upton, Matt Holliday, Hunter Pence. Clearly a step back from Cargo. But now he's injured. And apparently surgery's a possibility. So do I still want him ahead of that group? I don't know. It's a dilemma for me. I left him where he was, but I don't really feel good about it.
I gotta say, I went through, by the way, exact same thought process I went through in my last rankings update as well with Cargo.
I'm going to take the pressure off you guys and say that I don't think anyone could reasonably expect you to rank Carlos Gonzalez accurately right now. We have absolutely no idea what's gonna happen.
Ah, thank you.
So I wouldn't fault you for being wrong on this.
Well, what do you do as a Cargo owner? I mean, do you...
I'd sell him.
You'd sell him? So would you sell him for Hunter Pence or...
Yes.
Jay Bruce?
Maybe...
Let's figure out where to rank him right here.
I don't love Jay Bruce in weekly leagues.
Yeah.
It frustrates the heck out of me. But in a roto league where it's just end-of-season stats, I would. But, you know, but I'm very conservative. I don't like injury-prone players.
Yeah, I should have kind of picked up on that at some point. But, you know, because, you know, I thought, yeah, Hunter Pence, that's a good haul, Jay Bruce. But that's kind of just assuming that your worst-case scenario is going to happen with Cargo. And what if he has this surgery and, you know, he's out? I'm not even sure what period he'd be out for that, but he comes back and he's Cargo again.
Okay, but now's the time to make a decision.
No, right? I understand that.
So if you're understandably, we don't know what's going to happen, you're saying. But are you willing to take the optimistic approach and just hold on to him? Or
I think maybe this is something to add on to our later discussion of strategy.
Yeah, well, we'll get into it right now
because I
pretty much try to avoid the elite injury-prone players.
And I do on draft day, but if I've got Cargo now, I think I probably would not pull the trigger and trade it for Hunter Pence. And I like Hunter Pence, because I don't want to, you know, have to berate myself later in the season, you know, in retrospect, realizing, oh, I panicked and Cargo missed some time and then he was fine.
I mean, look, if you're 8-2, then maybe you don't do that. If you're 4-5, if you're 4-6. After this week, how much longer can you wait? You might need to get production right now. The thing with Cargo for me is like the knee injury, he's not stealing. So I had a thought maybe the DL would be good for him, get him healthy, and he'd come back and be a stolen base threat again. But if he doesn't steal bases, he's not
as
super
valuable.
Elite.
Yeah. But here's the thing, and here's something I probably need to do more of strategy-wise, is really look at the situation. Because, like you said, okay, if you're 8-2,
yeah,
you know, and then in that situation, what you're saying, so that you
yeah, maybe if you're 8-2, and you've got a good team, you can hold on to Cargo and play for the future. But if you need to win right now, I don't see how you can afford a long DL stint with your best player.
Okay, but like in our podcast points league, I'm 4-5, and I'm looking over my team and trying to figure out what happened here. And it's a situation where I tend to be very patient with players. And I'm looking at my roster. I'm saying, I think I drafted a pretty good roster. I think I drafted better than a 4-5 roster. And I don't think I'm going to do any kind of rebuilding here. And I'm going to just, you know, stick through it. Which is, I think, very different than if I've got a 4-5 team. I'm like, man, my team really stinks. I think I need to kind of throw a Hail Mary here. And I think in that situation, I do trade Cargo for the best player that I can get.
That's fair. You have to sort of evaluate if your team's just underachieving or if you blew it on draft day. So let's talk about strategies that worked, strategies that didn't work, and the floor is yours. How about the good?
You,
You want to take it, Mr. Melchior?
Well, I guess, yeah, I could kind of build a little momentum there.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that I had, patient in season management. And it's a strategy that I've stuck by, and it hasn't always served me well. You know, and I could think of, you know, at least one previous season in our podcast points league where, I mean, it was in exactly the situation where I am in now, where I got off to a disappointing start, had an underachieving team, which did do better in the second half. But I, you know, it wasn't enough. And, you know, when we kind of gathered here this morning and you said, you know, do you have your strategies that work and didn't work? I said, well, I've got a list of strategies. I'm not sure if this one works or not.
That's one of the things, because
sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't.
We're too early to decide if things worked or didn't work fully.
But even
we just still have a discussion.
Yeah, but even just in past years, you know, where there have been seasons where my patience has paid off.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, I think when you talk about leagues and being patient out, you got to consider the depth of the league.
Yeah.
And in a league as shallow as the one you're talking about, I am a little bit more aggressive in those types of leagues, especially with starting pitchers who are, you know, round like 15 or later. I'll play the waiver wire more, but you got to be in the deeper leagues. You have to be patient. You can't drop guys.
Right. There's not much worth picking up instead in the deeper leagues. And I think patience is good up to a point. I don't think I'm as patient as Al, but I think we're both a lot more patient than the general population, and it prevents us from shooting ourselves in the foot, because most of the time a guy with a track record of elite production is going to have elite production in the end, even if it takes him 6 to 8 weeks to start showing it. But we're more than 6 to 8 weeks in now, and somebody like Dominic Brown, if you know, I obviously would have drafted him to be my starter coming into the year. He's done absolutely nothing. Doesn't have an extensive track record, basically just last year. If it's a league like you're talking about, the 21-man roster, shallower head-to-head points league, and that kind of format, I like to use my bench for starting pitchers to maximize 2 start weeks, steal some wins that way. I don't know that it's so crazy to just go ahead and drop Brown at this point, because you obviously don't want him starting. In that format, it doesn't make a lot of sense to have him on your bench. So I think this is the part of the season, or really maybe like a week or two ago, where I start to make those decisions in a shallower league, and which is, when I say shallower, about standard size league. And it rarely backfires. It backfired last year with Victor Martinez, I remember, but that's just one player who, at the end of the day, probably wouldn't have made or probably didn't make or break my season by dropping him.
All right. Anything else, guys?
All right. I got a couple more here. And yeah.
Good.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
Took the floor from you.
No. So another
that's the point. We all group
that's
combo.
Right.
Group
so
chat.
One that I really like, and one that I'm not sure about. Okay, so I'm going to throw the other one I'm not sure about here. Buying into hot and cold second halves from the previous season. I think we all, you know, play that strategy, you know, with regularity. And I'm looking at three exceptions from this year: Ubaldo, Scott Kazmir, and Jason Wirth. And I'd have to say right now that's definitely one win, and two losses. Although I'm kind of on the fence. Still a little bit with Ubaldo, but you know, definitely
that's
only
a good
one clear win out of that. You know, so that's the you know, just about the smallest sample possible, a bad batting average. I just think just from a logical perspective that I've got to like question myself more when I draft somebody based on their second half performance, because you know, I made the argument with other kinds of stretches of time that, you know, if you put it in the middle of the season, you pay less attention to it, right?
Yeah.
If somebody slumps the beginning of the season, you know, a lot of times we overreact. If somebody is great at the end of the season, we say, oh, I got to remember this on draft day. But if it's in the middle of the season, you know, do you really make anything of it? And sometimes a hot finish is just a hot finish, even if it's for 2 or 3 months.
And I think, you know, you've got to look at it depends how much of a track record the guy has, right? Like,
yes.
You know, if he has a hot finish, but there's 2 years before where he hasn't been that good, Mm-hmm. You know, you got to look at the entire track record. You know, Chris Tillman's actually a guy I wanted to bring up today because he had a great finish second half of last season.
Oh, yeah.
350-ish ERA, strikeout per inning, and he's been a total bust.
He has been. But, you know, I don't want to – I think I can overreact to that, too. I agree with that. But you also have players like Jose Bautista, who went crazy the last 6 weeks of the season before he exploded with 54 home runs or whatever. And Josh Donaldson was kind of the same way. Before last year, he had a six-week stretch where he came up from the minors. There is such a thing as a midseason breakout. I think maybe the key is just not to be too presumptive about it. I mean, even after those hot finishes, Bautista and Donaldson were barely drafted at all. So it's not like you could have gotten them for really cheap and still benefited from it. You just don't want the kind of player who has a strong finish and everybody's onto it and he's going in round 7 or 8 because of it. And then, you know, maybe there's a good chance you're disappointed then.
All right, your last one?
All right, last one. This is one that I have done consistently over the years, and I like it and I stand by it, which is drafting or bidding, including fab bidding, for value and not for need. And, you know, this one's maybe more controversial than I thought it was, because there's a very good book out there by Larry Schechter called Winning Fantasy Baseball. And this is a guy who has just dominated the Tout Wars leagues for years.
Okay.
And, you know, he basically says, especially when you draft, that you really, and I hope I'm getting the argument right, because it's been a while since I've read the book. But you drafting for value can be really overrated, because if you're getting somebody at value at a position where there's not a lot of demand, you're just stuck with a guy who may be a surplus.
So wait, drafting for need could be overrated.
No. Drafting for like value. So like you have, you know, you've already got example from this year where I got, I think it was Miggy and Longoria.
Okay.
And I did it once by accident, but I did it again on purpose because I thought, okay, well, you know, if I can't use one for corner infield or utility, or if I have other options, you know, I've got trade bait, right? Now, at third base, that's not the best example because it's a very scarce position, and that probably would have worked. But at a position where there's less demand for that excess player, you're just stuck with him, and you're not maximizing your value across your roster.
Okay.
But I've sort of ignored that perspective, and I did this very, very recently in the Tout Wars Mixed League, where I had a winning bid on Tommy La Stella. I think it was $17, if I remember correctly, in Vickery bidding. And I already had Kinsler. Middle infield, I also had Desmond and Alexi Ramirez. And but I just thought, you know, I liked the value, and it allowed me to trade Kinsler. And I just, you know, I felt like that was a win, because when I go into a trading situation, I want to come from a position of strength. I want to come from a position of surplus.
So don't pass up a good player if you have that, if you don't need his position necessarily, if you can get him at a good value.
That's what I'm saying. That it's like, yeah, you know, when you're scouring the waiver wires, when you're looking at fab possibilities on draft day in the middle of a draft, you know, don't always just look for where you have the greatest need. If there's somebody who's just screaming value, 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 at a position where you're already set, mm-hmm. I still like to go after that player in all those situations.
Scott?
Yeah, so I think the most fascinating league or roster, actually, that I constructed was one we talked about a lot coming into the year. It was the overpay like crazy to get both Miggy and Trout in a roto league. And I got to say, I feel good about the way it's gone. Now, that's partially in relation to my other roto leagues. I'm doing poorly in most of them. It's kind of a strange thing this year. I'm crushing it in the head-to-head leagues. And
the points leagues.
The head-to-head points leagues, yeah. But
you're doing well in the categories league, too.
Yeah, but I'm doing pretty well in that one. But for the most part, the categories leagues, I'm not doing well at all, which kind of makes me wonder if I should re-examine the way I approach those, except that this is the first year there's been such a wide divide like that.
Right.
But this one league where I did Trout and Miggy is my best roto league. I'm in fifth, but I mean, within shouting distance, getting it first.
Somebody's kind of running away with it.
Yeah, you're in first place. But I don't think it's insurmountable. No. And especially since I haven't even really gotten anything from Hosmer or Jerko or I haven't gotten much from Segura yet, really, either. So there is, I think, some upside within my team.
Oh, and there's upside still with Trout and Cabrera. They haven't quite hit their stride yet.
Sure.
So, yeah, actually, I was specifically going to ask you about that team and if that was a good strategy. So,
now,
it's a 12-team Roto League, 30-man rosters, and you went nuts. You bid like 110-ish bucks on Trout, out of 260 on Trout and Cabrera.
Yeah. And remember my grave mistake, which looks even worse in retrospect, but I thought it was bad at the time. I got caught bidding Nando up on Jed Jerko, which was a completely Jerko thing to do. So I probably deserved it.
Yeah,
but
I got
Jerko for like $24 or something I would have never spent on him, even if I wasn't playing with a really tight budget the
you
rest of the
way. You caused that plantar fasciitis.
Yeah. Yeah, and so, I mean, that was my third most expensive player, and he's been terrible, and still I've come out in fifth place. But I thought what's really interesting with this team is the pitching staff, because of what happened with Jerko, I really had to go thrifty with the pitching staff. I drafted Shelby Miller as my ace. CJ Wilson and Hyunjin Ryu, I think, were two of my top three pitchers. And it's turned out to be, not so much because of those guys, but just because of how aggressively I play the waiver wire with starting pitchers and how plentiful they are, particularly in a Roto League. It's turned out to be a really good pitching staff. I've gotten 36.5 points from my pitching staff in that Roto League. Meanwhile, a Roto League where I own Cueto, Hamels, Kimbrel, James Shields, I've gotten only 23 points from that pitching staff. So a big difference.
Well, okay, I'm glad you brought that up, because what I was going to say was the strategy that worked the most for me was in that same exact league where you have Trout and Cabrera, and that's my best league right now, and I spent a lot on hitting, balanced it out a little bit more, obviously, but this is my pitching staff that I drafted. Homer Bailey for 12, Gio Gonzalez for 10, Cole Hamels for 9, Tanaka for 8, Lester for 5, and Quintana for 1. And that's pretty much exactly how I like to build those pitching staffs.
Yep.
I never get aces in those leagues because they go for $30, $25, $30, even more.
Oh, yeah.
And I never, ever get
I've
aces in those leagues.
In a roto, and obviously we're talking about a mixed league because there needs to be a waiver wire you're going to be able to tap into. With all the Dallas Keuchels and, you know, whoever else emerges that nobody's anticipating. I've spent as little as $25 on a pitching staff before, and I think I won the league that year.
Including relievers?
Including relievers.
Wow.
25 total.
Yeah, that scares me. I don't know if I could do that, but I guess you pulled it off.
Yeah.
All right, let's do a few more here. One of my strategies that didn't work, I invested too much on year two starting pitchers. But this is one that I could see at the end of the year working. Like, if for example, one of our leagues, our in-house head-to-head points league, Zach Wheeler and Chris Archer have mostly been bad for me. But right now, they look like they might be turning it around. But in our podcast points league, in round 9, I took Shelby Miller. In round 11, I took Danny Salazar. I was able to trade Salazar, but still, those were bad draftings.
Some chump.
So, yeah. But year two starting pitchers, they were disappointing last year. They're disappointing so far this year. We might overhype them. That's a very interesting storyline to keep track of as we prepare for 2015 drafting. How do those year two guys do? Now, then again, if instead of Salazar and Miller, I had gone Waka and Gray, you know, this would have been rainbows and butterflies.
Yeah.
But I didn't.
Well, and it would have been more of an investment, particularly for Waka,
yes,
to do that.
Yes.
And we talked about this a lot back in March, because that was a very, you know, conscious decision on your part. And I think, you know, Scott and I, to some degree, did the same thing, because it was, well, okay, are you going to get Waka or are you going to get, I mean, the name that pops in my head, but it's not really a great comparison, is Hiroki Kuroda. But I'm just, you know, the guys that just aren't, you know,
less
they're
upside.
Steady, but there's no upside there.
Maybe, yep. Yep, I know exactly what you mean, but your two starting pitchers, I think, are something that I'm keeping an eye on going into next year,
mm-hmm,
and whether or not we're going to overhype them.
Yeah, I've fallen into the trap of overhyping year two players in general, I feel like, and more often than not, I mean, Trout's an obvious exception, but more often than not, they don't live up to their draft position, I feel like. I mean, I'm going way back to the Hosmer and Brett Laurie years.
Yeah.
Jason Hayward.
Will Myers.
Yeah, Will Myers hasn't. Yeah. But then you got Puig, too. But I feel like that's a situation where, I mean, you pass up Puig in the second round, you're probably satisfied with whoever you drafted instead, you know? Like, I just don't know that it's... Even if it's worth ranking a player that way, I don't know that you want to be the one to take him in that unnecessary risk.
Okay. Anything else? Scott, you got one more?
I don't. Sorry.
Okay. That's fine.
If you want, I'll throw in one more, which is that my closer strategy totally blew up this year. In most of my leagues, I'm shorthanded. I drafted Nate Jones in a lot of leagues. And you could kind of find fault in two different ways with that, because one, not that I was investing a lot, but I was investing still, you know, meaningful draft picks, you know, like teens, on somebody who hadn't won a job yet. I did a similar thing with Corey Dickerson, and I still think that one could pan out for me. But could also just fault me in terms of just getting to the point where my second reliever was, you know, my choices were between high upside guys without a definite lock on a job, you know, and, you know, lesser upside guys that, you know, maybe now you talk about, you know, I think neither of you really target stud closers very often. Well, I'm feeling remorse that I wasn't more aggressive.
Okay. I've got it. This is how I feel about closers now. In a shallower league where there are waiver wire options, and like last week I picked up Henry Mejia and Rondon is out there, you know, I don't prioritize it at all. If I just looked at the top relief pitchers in those head-to-head points leagues, even if you remove the Sparps, like K-Rod and Houston Street are 1 and 2, and that's how it's going to be. Like Kimbrel and Holland, they're going to end up in the top 10. They're not necessarily going to end up 1 and 2. Kimbrel probably will, but I think they're just... I'm not going crazy on elite closers in leagues where it's not scarce. In leagues where closers are scarce, I actually like drafting for job security. I don't want to spend a lot of money, let's say in an auction, on Kimbrel or whatever. But if I'm going to spend money, I want it on guys who are going to have some type of leash, that if they do struggle, they're not going to lose that job. So that's kind of what I'm targeting. I just don't want a guy who's going to lose his damn job, even if I think he has a lot of upside.
Of course, that is kind of hard to predict
in
and of itself.
Well, I mean...
Like Jim Johnson seemed like he had job security.
Jim Johnson's a bust, and they're always going to be busts like that. But, yeah, I don't want to approach situations like Nate Jones.
Or Axford.
Joe Nathan's a good example, because we feel like he has to be so bad to lose that job. Axford, there were other good arms in that bullpen.
Right. No, I'm saying Axford was one who seemed like he could be risky coming in.
Greg Holland's elite, but even when he struggled last year, they weren't giving that job away. I'm just trying to think of other...
Perkins,
right. He's never going to lose that job. Even Houston Street, I think, would have a long leash until he gets
injured. Yeah, no, it's the injury thing with him.
Yeah. So, I don't know. It's just kind of my thing with closers. You can't always go that way. There may not be enough to go around, but I don't want a guy who I think has a good chance of losing his job if he struggles. All right, let's move on. And since we took a while with that, a little bit of a different show today, I'll let you guys give us your hitter and pitcher advice. Scott, for week 11, who are you targeting?
All right, so busy week, a lot of 7-game weeks for teams. The Marlins and Cardinals, though, both play only 5 games. They're among the 5 worst matchups because of it. I have the Athletics, though, actually, with the worst matchups, because they play 6 games against the Angels, and they face Tanaka in a series against the Yankees. So, tough matchups for them. Somebody who you might consider sitting because of that, I have Derek Norris, who, since he's taken over as the primary catcher, playing mostly against right-handers as well as left-handers, hasn't been doing so well. And I think it's a deep enough position that you can find alternatives. Jed Lowry, too. It's kind of like a situation with D. Gordon last week. Well, shortstop is so weak that you probably can't sit him there. But second base is deep. And if that's where you're used to using him, this probably isn't the week for it. And getting back to the 5-game, team, one of the five-game teams, the Cardinals, Oscar Tavares, who is widely started, given the hype. Other than the home run in the first game, isn't off to a great start, and in a five-game week, you probably shouldn't expect much from him anyway, especially since Nationals are who they're facing in three of those games.
Ooh.
Yeah. So let's get into some good matchups, though. The best I have is the Cubs. The problem there is obviously Rizzo and Castro you start, and nobody else. Tigers, the Blue Jays, the Braves, and the Red Sox are my five best matchups. The Blue Jays are especially interesting because they face nothing but right-handers in their seven games, which is really good news for both Adam Lind and Juan Francisco. I have a little more confidence in Lind than Francisco, but Francisco obviously is eligible at third base, which helps his cause. Some other lefty-righty situations that are going to benefit fantasy owners this week. The Indians, they weren't in the five best matchups, but they didn't miss by much, and they face six right-handers in their seven games. Lonnie Chisenhall hasn't really cooled off yet. I actually like him even more than Francisco this week. He's my start at third base. I'll add that Baltimore was also a near miss in the good matchups. Markakis isn't my start in the outfield because I didn't really want to pick against Josh Willingham. But Markakis has been really hot of late, homer to back-to-back games, and should be able to take advantage of the matchups against the Red Sox and Blue Jays rotations this week.
All right, then. Al, let's do some pitching stuff.
All right.
So I guess we have a lot of two-star pitchers, huh?
We do have a lot of two-star pitchers, and not that many that I really like. And this is kind of a weird situation this week, at least, you know, through my eyes, because when I do the column every week and we do the segment on our show, I identify a dozen pitchers who I call borderline pitchers who are not must-starts for me, but not guys that I would absolutely avoid. And it doesn't just usually works out to be a good number. You know, some weeks there might be a stretch of, you know, a couple guys at the end, or there might be one or two guys that I leave off that list that, you know, I might actually consider starting. But that seems to be kind of the number of pitchers that fall in that gray area. This week, there is no gray area. There are two-star pitchers I would absolutely start and two-star pitchers that make me really nervous. But okay. That said, I'm still going into the show today and going to the column with 12 pitchers who are borderline options, but I am less confident about the guys that I'm recommending. So the one.
Hold on.
All right.
Justin Verlander, start or sit?
He's in the borderline group and he's in the lower half, so he's a sit unless you're desperate.
R.A. Dickey, Minnesota at home, Baltimore on the road.
Two spots ahead of Verlander, so I feel a little bit more confident about Dickey.
Jesse Chavez. Angels on the road, Yankees at home.
Yeah, and one spot ahead of Dickey. He makes me nervous, but, you know, give him a try if you need that extra start.
Well, looks like I'm hitting the spot here.
You are hitting the spot. This is the right the sweet spot right in the middle of the good and the bad.
Liriano, Cubs and at the Marlins.
I'm willing to give him. This is kind of where I draw the line of guys that I feel comfortable with. He's really on the other side of that line, but he's just under it. So I think you should start him.
Oh, man.
I'll give him one more chance.
There are so many two-star pitchers. Tyler Skaggs, Oakland and at Atlanta. He's so unpredictable and so inconsistent.
Well, and you could say that about pretty much everybody on this list.
Porcello, Leak, Liriano, Skaggs, Vargas, Yankees at home and at the White Sox.
Yeah.
Vogelsong. So, Vogelsong's a start, right?
He is not for the reasons you would start him, I think, because I know you just like him.
Yeah.
And I still am not really sold on him. And we talked about this, I think, on the show yesterday. The high strand rate, some of the you know, indicators that could be luck indicators that have been there for him in the past. Luck could run out at some point. But the one thing that Vogelsong does consistently is pitch very well at AT&T Park, and he has two home starts.
Yeah.
And there's enough that is good there that I can start Vogelsong with confidence.
Okay, sorry. So I didn't mean to steal your thunder. There seemed to be a lot of really bad two-star pitchers that we can probably ignore. But what about the Porcellos and the Leaks and the Skaggs and the Vargas and the Burnetts and the –
Yeah, those guys are all – okay, Burnett, no. Absolutely no. All right. Porcello, no, I wouldn't start him either. And Cingrani did not make the cut even on the questionable borderline list.
Terrible matchups.
So those guys, no way. And that's, you know, losing out on spots on the borderline list too. Travis Wood, who's got the last spot on that list, and I don't feel confident at all, but I'd rather start Wood than Cingrani, Porcello, or Burnett.
The only one I would disagree with you on is Porcello.
Yeah, I kind of like Porcello too.
I don't know. I mean,
I mean, in a two-star week, not
at the White Sox, which could be tough, home against Minnesota, I think that should be
Minnesota's
all right.
Fine. Yeah, Travis Wood, and again, in probably a typical week, I would agree with you, but Wood is at Pittsburgh, at Philadelphia. I like
He's just been terrible, though.
I like those
terrible
matchups.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think this seems like a week where you start your one start, guys.
For the most part, yeah. So I'll really try to emphasize that.
Vargas is interesting, Al. He's a start for you?
He's the start that at Chicago White Sox one does scare me. With a better matchup, he would have been much higher on the list. But the Yankees, the worst team in baseball in Kansas City, that should be a good start for Jason Vargas.
All right.
I want to just point out one more guy, and this is going to probably stir Scott up a little bit.
Oh, no.
Josh Beckett.
Oh, you don't want to start him?
He's on the borderline list, but he is in the lower half, one spot below Verlander. And it's, again, partly a matchups thing. I do not like him at Cincinnati. I know the Reds have struggled offensively, but they've actually been hitting for power at home, and that is Beckett's Achilles heel, as he gives up a lot of home runs.
And I still think, though, in a week where there's not many two-star pitchers, I mean, maybe he gives up two home runs in that game, it results in five earned runs. Like, it's not the end of the world, especially when he has a second start coming up, and maybe that doesn't happen, you know?
Maybe, but then, you know, I am a pessimist when it comes to Josh Beckett. That you know, the second weakness for him is walks. So I'm not sure, you know, other like a Marco Estrada, I say, okay, maybe he gives up, you know, three solo home runs. Beckett, I worry about the disaster potential more in that kind of
start. He had a five-walk start earlier this year, but otherwise I feel like his control's been pretty good.
I think he's pitching pretty well.
Yeah.
But,
All right, last one.
The appearances, again, low BABIP guy, Beckett, this year. I don't expect that to last.
Right, because, you know, it's BABIP. So.
Right. Well, for that, I don't know the reason.
Miners got at Philadelphia and home against the Angels. I'm sorry, at Colorado and home against the Angels. Any hesitancy?
That could be bad, but, you know, especially in this week, you start them. And frankly, I start Miner one start, two starts, matchups irrelevant. He's a must start for me.
Let's read some emails to finish the show. Reggie from Charlotte has a strategy that's been working for him in a 10-team points head-to-head league. They have an auction, though. He's in third place, but he scored the second most hitting points, fifth most pitching points. My auction strategy was to spend big on hitters and pick up pitchers during the season. I've picked up Loesch, Garrett Richards, Vogelsong, Tyler Skaggs, Keuchel, Nice, Sean Doolittle. I think that, pretty much what we've been saying, especially in a 10-team league.
Yep.
When the options are like that. Okay, another one. Sam in Raleigh says, hello, Face Murdoch and B.A. Baracus.
That's a team, right?
It's got to be it. I wrote a week ago about punting saves in a 12-team head-to-head categories league with strikeouts per nine and quality starts as additional categories. So far, so good. Betances, Wade Davis, and Tony Watson have been filling up K per nine, ERA and whip, and wins. It's been working for me. So he's been good since he punted the saves category.
Yeah, those are good non-closer options there.
I think the fact that there's a K per nine makes it easier to punt saves.
Oh, then as opposed to just straight strikeouts?
Yeah, well, I agree with that. When there are additional – yes, and when there are additional categories, it means that any one particular category is less important when there are seven pitching categories as opposed to five.
I want to count on them to keep filling up wins, though.
Correct.
If that's happened, I don't know how many wins those three have, but if that's happened so far, you don't see many relievers win double-digit games.
All right. Andrew says, 12-team head-to-head league, would you trade Posey to try to get an elite pitcher if you could replace Posey with Maurer? And if you would trade Posey, what pitchers do you think you could get for him?
Well, I would do it. I like the idea. Who would I trade Posey for? I'm thinking just a guy.
Verlander.
No, better than that. I was okay. The name that popped in my head is Bumgarner. I'm not sure if you can get him, but
I don't think you can.
Bumgarner, Hamels.
You're saying an ace.
Yeah. Well, what, just short. I mean,
what about Waka?
Yeah, I think I would certainly, if I couldn't, you know, if I got a no on that, I would accept Waka. I would accept Iwakuma. Mike Minor.
Chris from Guatemala says, "Dear buddy guy, and I'm not your buddy guy." Do you expect, that's South Park, by the way. Do you expect to rank Matt Harvey as an elite pitcher going into next season? And he forgot, friend. All right. I'm not your guy, buddy.
I don't know that I'll have him ranked as elite because I'm not sure you're going to need to rank him that high, especially since there's been so many Tommy John disasters lately, pitchers coming back and it not working out, them needing a second surgery. But I do think Harvey is going to be better off than most because provided he doesn't get his way and return to make five starts at the end of last season, he'll have a good year and a half plus to recover, as opposed to it seems like a lot of pitchers just take a year now.
Yep.
So that I would like him as a sleeper next year, but he'll probably be outside my top 20 going into it.
Thanks, fellas. Watch Fantasy Baseball Today live noon Eastern. Adam Azer, Scott White, I'm Melchior. Have a great weekend. Good luck finishing up week 10, and we'll see you in week 11.